This is John Costa on Spotlight on Heritage. Welcome to this week's recording, and I'm here with Rob Watson. Rob, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Cool, keeping well?
Yeah, not too bad.
And the sun's shining.
Is it? I hadn't noticed.
For those that listen to any of our recordings, we made a conscious decision to stop mentioning the weather, but actually the sun's come out, so that's quite good. But the nights are drawing in, aren't they?
They are. Very much an early autumnal feel, and leaves on the ground, so...
Right, so this week I'd like to have a conversation with you and talk about the upcoming Saturday Heritage Fair that we're doing at the...
So we're turning the tables.
We're turning the tables.
So what is the Saturday Heritage Fair?
Oh, hang on. He hit a early return across the net there, straight back to me. So the Saturday Heritage Fair is, I think it's the fifth one, actually. If we don't include Military History Live, which is a kind of similar event but themed around military history, then it's the fifth event that we've done at Adult Education. So we have the... Handsome Hall. We have a group of stalls in there. And then we also use the cafe area, the old library cafe area, and a couple of the classrooms for the talks. And this time we've got two really exciting things. We've got an Afghan language cafe. So Kadir, who's an Afghan journalist, is taking the lead with that. So bringing along items, finding out what they are in Pashto and Farsi, which should be quite interesting. And then also where we've got the talks that are upstairs and downstairs. I think we've got four or five talks at the moment. We've got the Doc Space mixed media exhibition taking place in the basement gallery for 3 weeks, which kind of wraps it. So it means actually for the exhibition, it's open on the Saturday for Saturday Heritage Fair. So I think there's going to be four or five workshops downstairs. So it's a real kind of different feel to it this time as well. We've expanded it a lot more sort of family learning. And obviously we've got Saw Sound and Radio Lear. They're doing broadcasting and community reporters with Evington Echo. So I'm really looking forward to it.
What are the, first of all, what's the reason for doing it? Let's explore that. What's the need for independent heritage, and what does that mean?
I think it's pushing back against that cultural snobbery. I wrote about it recently on a blog post where there's this overriding need to control heritage and what it looks like and who's worthy of being put into heritage and cultural settings and put behind glass, and it's all very carefully controlled. And I hate that. I like the independent side of it, which is, you know, if someone's sitting there with a bag of photographs or something that they've inherited through a family connection, I don't mean like house clearance. We can talk about house clearance in a minute. But I think, you know, if an item's come to you in the family and you're now the custodian of that memory of your family's migration, fleeing conflict or whatever to the UK, or you've moved from somewhere else, or you've got evidence of your... family's involvement in an event or from a mining area or something like that, why can't you have your story told or shared or put on display in a museum or cultural setting? Why does it have to be a carefully controlled narrative about community engagement? I mean, we have this whole thing in Leicester at the moment about sort of, you know, Richard Renoir and Romans, I call it, where it kind of the narrative has been completely dominated by the King Richard story. Quite, I mean, you know, fantastic story, one of many. The Renoir painting come to, you know, the Leicester Museum and Art Gallery on Newark, which was renamed. Everything's all about Renoir and stuff like that. Great, but again, you know, if you're not interested in art, a bit like not being interested in football because they've won the Premiership, do you have to be interested in football? And then, you know, now with the whole Roman thing, you know, with Jewry Wall opening, fantastic. If that's something you're interested in, then go. But not to the exclusion of other culture. And someone might come on and say, well, that's not true because we do this, this and this. But it's still you controlling that narrative. And when they talk about co-production and co-facilitation and working with community groups and stuff like that, it never feels to me, personally, as someone who's into this kind of thing, feels as if it's genuine. And if I'm doing someone a disservice, well, I'm sorry about that, but that's my opinion. And this year I've been empowered to have my own opinion by you. And so rather than trying to be a facilitator all the time, I'm turning around and saying, well, let's organise events where people can come in, find out about their inherited cultural items, heritage items that they've got from their family. And where does that fit? And I think what I'm trying to do with the Saturday Heritage Fairs is give everyone an equal chance to find out what that means to them and where that fits in the overall narrative, and particularly the conflict memory related stuff, you know, like World War II, World War I and all these kinds of things. You know, it's very easy to go on and get some factual information about an item and where it fits in the timeline of who fought, who won, how many died and when it ended. But where's the understanding for that connection to your family? No matter what background, nationality, ethnicity you are, at the end of the day, there's always lots going on. Because I think, you know, I launched a project a couple of weeks ago, you know, World War II at 90, which is the next 4 years to 2029, which people might find a bit strange, but it's 90 years from the start of World War II. So, you know, 1939 to 2029. And for the next 4 years, we'll be just talking about, well, what kind of impact did World War II have? You know, and we watch maybe Remembrance Sunday or Armistice Day, and World War I's gone now after the 100th anniversary in 2018. But we're still talking about the consequences. Why? Because Brexit, all the stuff going on in the media at the moment about boats coming over, migration, the British Empire, colony, waving flags, whose flag is it, who owns it, where's it come from? It all stems back to the last global conflagration that we had, which was, you know, World War II. And, you know, we seem to be being groomed, in inverted commas, for World War III. And at any moment we could be, you know, at war again in Europe. If you're Ukrainian, you might already disagree that we're actually at war in Europe already. But we need to understand why we have relationships with certain people. Where did NATO come from? What does Section 5 mean? Why is a European army opposed to a NATO army? Where does America fit with all of that kind of stuff, you know, with their isolationism at the beginning of World War I and World War II? You know, Trump talks about that with, he joined in 1941, America, you know, we'd already been at war a couple of years with our, you know, our very good friends who are economic migrants now, the Poles, you know, so we really need to understand it because we do not teach it in school.
So when somebody comes to the Heritage Fair and there's this, huge scope of possible ways of thinking about all of this, from the global to the local to the community to personal to families.
Your living room, yeah, your own living room.
Yeah, so this is a kind of lived experience. I just want to focus on this idea of independence and kind of really see if we can think through what that means. Why is that? Why are we in a position where that sort of independence is kind of downgraded? It's not really. What do we mean by independence? Is independence is often used as kind of it's an advocacy or social action way of doing things. You know, you're campaigning for something, but that's not. I don't think that's what you mean by this. What do you mean by that level of independence?
Well, it's being able to present your own family story or your own lived experience in a way where it's valued with equity round a table. You know, that kind of King Arthur, Camelot sort of round table, you know, there was no one in charge, they were all equal kind of thing. Now, that might be a very utopian way of thinking about it. And obviously, you know, we're never not going to have conflicts or wars or any of these kind of things. But at the same time, we need to be talking to the younger generation about speaking to the older generation, this intergenerational learning, family learning, where it's about, these are the stories of your family. Now, if you buy into that kind of very short attention span that social media is very good at, that kind of TikTokable history, if you like, of your family's narrative, then I think you're ill-equipped to be able to push back against some of the agendas and the narratives that politicians weave with the media's complicity about who is worthy and who isn't worthy.
Because that Camelot model is includes the peasant. You know, you're talking about the aristocracy. The knights were aristocrats. You know, and it's kind of it served them well. But it, you know, you're not talking about the serfs who worked in their fields or the, you know, the people who worked in the kitchens in the castles.
Well, I think now you can. I mean, back then, you couldn't. I mean, at the end of the day, sort of, you know, serfs and lords and all that kind of hierarchy and stuff, you know, was there. And then, you know, the great democratizer, and we don't really talk about this much, like social media and the internet, people's ability to be able to go on unfiltered, you know, so for right and wrong, share their narrative story. Of course, you know, can peddle certain mistruths, untruths, misperceptions or conceptions about people. But to be able to go on and authentically share your family's lived experience as a Rohingya who's been driven out of Myanmar and is now living in a refugee camp in Bangladesh, they don't need the mainstream media. They don't need some white European global North person coming and interviewing them to put them on CNN or France 24 to give them a voice. They're able to be able to control what they want to say and actually say, this is what is happening to me in real time. So that's the mainstream media or the news. So you've got this digital media space that also allows people down at the heritage perspective at the bottom to talk about, well, this is my experience of the Windrush. This is my experience of being second or third generation Irish who come over to Leicester after the war looking for work, and how I was treated compared to black people, and, you know, the signs that were about me long before the Ugandan Asians arrived in 1972. And we tend to put so much onus on making sure that other people's stories are told and represented in that way, that we tend to forget the stories that were there that we should be telling. Now, you know, conversations with my mum, for example, we talk about, you know, people that we know in Australia and New Zealand and stuff, you know, that were built from convicts being sent. So, you know, you're talking about the amount of white people who were in indentured slavery that were sent to America and Australia and New Zealand and stuff. And of course, you know, what happened to those Indigenous people and First Nation people and stuff like that, you know, is wrong, you know, as much as it was in America as it is in New Zealand and Australia. But we also need to bear in mind that those people that went didn't go because they volunteered. They were sent because they were trying to feed themselves and then stole a loaf of bread and then, you know, went into the town hall here, and children get sent off to suddenly become convicts in this colony halfway around the world. Where are we telling those stories? How does that nation tell its story about its early settlers that we can learn about, that we're forgetting about the stories of, you know, people like, you know, Cockneys like myself, you know, non-posh Londoners. So Cockney's gone from just being the East End to being anybody in London who's a non-posh Londoner. Cockney's now been kind of taken on by some of those people.
Appropriated.
Culturally appropriated. Someone south of the river describing to me that they're a Cockney is quite funny, south of the Thames from Bermondsey. But it's that kind of thing. It's not about whether it's right or it's wrong or who's worthy or isn't worthy. It's turning around, well, if that's your story, then that's important to your family. And it just helps you make an understanding of a particular area and a particular maybe episode that happened.
So you're listening to Spotlight on Heritage with the tables turned this week. So I'm Rob Watson and I'm speaking with John Costa this week, who's normally asking the questions.
I'm tub thumping.
And John's a hard interviewer because he's really very good at controlling other people's time, but he it's not so much his own.
This is very painful.
Yes. Anyway, I wanted to ask about what the actual Heritage Fair then provides for people. It sounds like it's a kind of anchor point, because there's something that comes. You can open this up, as you said, about, you know, there's a distributed or dispersed network of people, you know, a network, people out there with doing lots of things. Like social media is a really good example of this. You've got your own interests, you've got your own hobbies, you collect things, but you're not anchored. And there's a really strong interest in, you know, it's like, I'm off the top of my head, the model train enthusiasts, they meet up and they have a convention and they, you know, and a fair or a festival where they bring all of their set things up and it's like a massive event. Or, you know, there's the Lego building community, there's the Comic Cons. There is a strong interest for people to have these anchor points. What's the benefit, and what do you hope that the Heritage Fair is as an anchor point for people who are doing otherwise separate types of projects?
Well, I come at it from two perspectives. There's the people that attend and there's the people that have the displays. So I remember when I set up the very first one and I spoke to some of the organisations that go, and I said to them, you know, where do you normally attend? And they mentioned two large heritage related fairs, one that's in the north of Leicester and one that's in south of Leicester. And I just said to them, well, you know, what's it like? They go, oh, it's packed. There's always loads of people and stuff like that. And I go, okay, so what do you get out of it? And they go, oh, we get some sign-ups and, you know. And I said, okay, so like 9 or 10 deep people. And they were like, yeah. I said, well, what happens if you want to speak to number 8? You know, that person there is the person you should speak to, might help your project. You might have the answer for those people. But then we've got the usual suspects going to the usual things. So it's really busy. And they said, yeah, it's really busy. And I said, do you get to eat your lunch? And they looked at me like I was crazy. I remember the same people did it. You know, what do you mean? I said, well, do you get to eat your lunch? No, it's crazy. There's so many people. I said, okay. So do you speak to the people on your left or the people on your right? Oh, no, don't get a chance to speak to them because it's just crazy. Okay. And do you ever get a chance to, like, you know, give one of the talks or even attend someone else's talk? Oh, no, there's too many people. It's crazy. And so people always saying to me, how many people attend your events? And I really don't care, you know, because what I know is that when I've spoken to people that have got their exhibits, they turn around and say, oh, fantastic, had some great conversations. Every person I spoke to, I added to my mailing list. Never realised this person on the next organisation did this, the person on the right. I went off, managed to have a really nice lunch in the old library cafe. Conversations, fantastic. Even caught one of the talks. So I said, so you enjoyed it? And they were like, yeah. I said, so it's never for you. You attend to help everybody else. It's never about you. And of course, the ultimate irony is I organise these events that I'd like to go to. And then I get stressed and I'm never going to do it again. You know, that late night, Saturday night, I'm never going to do these things again. And of course, the first thing you do the next morning is make a plan for the next one. And then the person that attends, it's more about, I there's too much and I feel that everybody wants me to join. Or maybe people are looking for me to sign up for £16 a month for their mailing list or join their thing. And, you know, all I wanted to do was ask a question. So why do I have to join? You know, who can help me do this? Now, don't get me wrong. You can go online and you can find out the information and all that sort of stuff in a kind of two-dimensional way. But that comes back to the conversations that you and I have had many times with Sue Lester at Family History Society, which is people turn up and go, hey, I went on ancestry.com and find my past and I joined and then I hit this brick wall. And then they come to a human at the Research Centre for the Family History to ask, can you help me get through this brick wall? Well, of course you can, because all it is, it's designed for you to just keep paying. So you come into the Saturday Heritage Fair and it's like, I've got this item, can you help me? Well, of course, that's why we're here. And then I will probably take you to the most unlikeliest person to answer your question from your perception, because I know the people that I've invited, the reason they're there is because they're able to answer some of those questions. Someone said to me, oh, it sounds like the Antiques Roadshow. I said, yes, but could you imagine you would turn up if I said it was like the Antiques Roadshow? So what you're constantly doing is you're fighting against people's perceptions of what it could be. And that's why my marketing or media or, you know, the advert on Soar Sound, for example, is very much around, you know, are you the custodian of your family's heritage items? You might not have wanted them, but suddenly for some reason in the pit of your stomach, you've got this reason to turn around and go, well, no one knows that about granddad or grandma, or no one knows that about my family, or I'm second, third generation. I'm ignorant of my own journey here. Whether you're a new arrival, a recent arrival, or an old arrival, you know, at the end of the day, we keep thinking about people that are arriving. Well, the island that we live on, we've been invaded many times, and we've got Irish heritage and Scottish heritage and all that sort of stuff. So we're all moving from somewhere. This perception that white indigenous people have always been fixed in this location with one particular flag needs to be thrown out, and then people will be a bit more educated about it. I'm happy to have those conversations because you can actually illuminate someone's backstory a lot more for them, and they're not entrenched in their own ignorance.
So you're listening to Spotlight on Heritage with me, Rob Watson, and this week it's John Costa and I having a conversation about that Saturday Heritage Fair that John organises, which will be on the 11th of October at the Leicester Adult Education Centre on Beaver Street. It uses all the rooms. It uses the old library and Handsome Hall. And we'll be there for Soar Sound, capture and stories on the day. And I wanted to ask you about the importance of kind of, this really relates to people having an object or a set of objects that relate to people on the basis that it's a story. It prompts a story or it encapsulates a story. What are the kind of stories that you like hearing about and finding out about? Because when you know, you talk to lots of people, you're organising things, but at the back of your mind, or even at the front of your mind, actually what you're there to do is to engage with people's stories. What are the ones that get you, you know, that bring you back to wanting to do it again?
I always say, when people say to me, what item should I bring? I say, what would you grab in a fire? And they go, what do you mean? I say, well, what would you grab in a fire? If you could grab one item, what would you mean? Because that has some kind of deeply personal resonance with you as to why you're grabbing it. And that might be a photo album, some other people, it might be something from their grandma.
I'm going to be really cheeky. Yeah, yeah. If there was only one exhibitor that you could have, which one would it be? No, that's terrible. It's so disrespectful to everybody else who comes along. You say, I love them all.
I put them all in the right place, particularly if they want power.
Yeah.
No,
I notice you're not going to include Sorsound in this list. So.
Yeah, well, no, it's okay. Of course. Well, that's family, isn't it? You know. One particular exhibitor, I think when people look at who's been in the last four, and maybe sort of the military history lives or who's coming now, people are like, it's such an eclectic mix of people. And I go, well, this is the thing. You know, suddenly it's heritage. It's all got to be the 10 past four on a Thursday society and the sort of, you know, keep all windows Georgian society. Because people tend to think of heritage and they either think of museums or they think of buildings and locations and things that you would like the clock tower. I'm doing something with the Turkey Cafe down in the Dockspace Mixed Media exhibition, just as a way of getting people to think about it. But it's got a bit of Lego in it and someone who's drawn something, you know, and some photography. So it's trying to get people to think of things differently and that each generation can have a particular view of a building and what it's for, but also it's the people.
And it's the lived, I mean, it's a cliche phrase, isn't it? The lived experience of those people. What you know, we have to figure out a better way of explaining what that means. But it's like, you know, it's how do we make our lives meaningful? And what are the stories are about that? That's how we make our lives meaningful.
And it's making sense of where you are in the world and your place in it. Because I think what happens then is you're much more able to comment about how you want your city to be rather than just thinking about how it used to be. Well, you can't live in the past, you know.
Do you think we've lost the art of storytelling? You know, the kind of... You know, it's often said that, you know, you go to Ireland or you go, you know, grew up in Liverpool, but you go to Liverpool, it's like there's a storyteller. You know, every pub you walk into is either, you know, there's a comedian or a storyteller. You'll get caught with somebody who's going to be telling you loads of stories. Is that because it's been professionalized and it has to be for a purpose? Stories don't, I mean, we call it like folk culture, where you're, you know, fairy tales, folk tales, common stories between people. We don't sit around and listen to people. I mean, you've always described about your dad's stories and, you know, kind of the growing up in the East End and the war and all that kind of stuff is kind of family stories. We've farmed this out to social media platforms and we're filling our head. I've deleted off my phone. I've still got the account, my Instagram account, because I realized reels were just, or shorts, whatever they're called on there, just getting into my head and too negative, really pernicious, really, you know, it's a vile addiction, I think. They're exploiting that. But we could be filling that with really fantastic stories. So what should we, you know, and heritage, that's what you're really doing. You're not collecting things, you're collecting stories.
And I think picking up on something you said earlier about, you know, have we allowed the professionalization of stories, you know, what stories are worthy, who's worthy of having their story told. And we've seen that in the media and that's moved into the heritage scape now, I think, the storytelling. But I think also you've got the commercialization of storytelling through things like streaming platforms and those that, you know, need lots of content. So suddenly it's about, you know, why do you get three films about the world ending? You know, so when you look at the role of popular culture in telling you what's coming, or what is worthy or what's included. And then you'll get a random film that will come out and smash it out the ballpark. And people go, what was so amazing about that? I said, well, it wasn't a universe. You know, it was a genuinely meaningful story that was about something that was important. And so for me, it's very much around empowering people to tell their own story, which is authentic because it's theirs. And I think recently I was in Nigeria a couple of weeks ago and we did a workshop about Storytelling Lab on the Saturday, and I said to them, I want to talk to you about AI. And they all leant forward and I said, not that AI, I want to talk to you about actual intelligence. So like the people in this room here all have things they know about people, places and events that are well documented historically or in the news. How do we get those stories from you to add to that? Because that's an authenticity. You've got a viewpoint on that story that is not out there. AI can't, artificial intelligence can't scrape what you haven't told it. You know, it's only when you have all of that information online for it to be able to find, can it give you that answer. But you've got the perfect antidote to that AI. You've got actual intelligence. Are you empowered enough to tell your own story and share it in a way that people connect with and resonate with. Well, of course, what happens is, and we did this with Citizen's Eye in 2008 to 2014 here in Leicester, you have all of these disparate people sitting around the table from the Sikh community, the Jewish community, the Muslim community, Ugandan Asians, you know, people from New Parks. You've got all of these people here. I say, okay, so rather than talk about one big issue, let's talk about, do we think it's safe to walk the streets of Leicester? What we think about education? What do we think about employability? You know, what do we think about being safe? What do we think about voting? Are we represented? And suddenly, before you know it, you've got like 85, 90, 95, 99% consensus around the table about things that are real and that are important. And then suddenly all the things that in the headlines in the mainstream media, and this is really where community media came in, about you being able to turn around and say, well, actually, I've got an opinion about that. That's not my community. You know, if you're a gypsy traveller, do you buy into the popular culture or do you turn around and write your own blog, which is, well, this is my experience of what it's like. And I think this is the thing that's important. It's about being able to give people the opportunity to share that, but also to have an item they bring along that is explained to them in a way that is actually important and with a genuine sort of empathy towards why they've got that item in their family.
So, John, you've probably heard the phrase nostalgia isn't where it used to be.
Not for a while.
Yeah. What stops this falling into a kind of longing for a memory of the past, which is actually false? My mum sits around with her friends and they have conversations and they inevitably get onto what it was like when you were growing up here 50 years ago kind of thing. And she said it was never as good as they make out.
Well, it's the good old days. And it's the good old days. What was so good about
them? The romanticisation of it. How do we stop this from becoming a kind of, you know, it's like the motherland was really great. It's like, actually, it wasn't. You had to leave, you know, kind of approach. You know, we all have this tendency to romanticise the past and that memory of that. How do we keep on the right side of that? What is the right side of that?
I think by having an eclectic mix of people that are doing those kind of heritage projects and being able to learn from people that have finished or are about to start or slightly ahead or slightly behind you with your heritage project. And it's not about just a nostalgic view of remembering what it was like, but actually what kind of impact did that then have on now? And then how can we look towards tomorrow with that level of understanding and see things slightly differently, which, you know, the story I always find fascinating as well is when you watch any of these kind of documentaries and it's about, you know, black people in the UK or black people in Britain, you know, Roman times and all this sort of stuff. And you go, well, how did these people suddenly get eradicated that were having to fight to tell West Indian, Caribbean contributions to World War One, like Trek did, you know, the Race Equality Centre here in 2014, 2018, the century. Why are they fighting to get that story told if we've had someone who's been black here since the Roman times? That's, for me, that's the thing. It's making sense of, you know, things like, you know, is it systemic, some of the racism that you have? You know,
It works the opposite way as well. And then I know there's a kind of a pushback against colourblind casting in things like Netflix, you know, period dramas, that you have Jane Austen novels and the casting is that can be as problematic as, you know, historical accuracy. What is, you know, that's the, what is meant by that? And you need to kind of argue. That's, I suppose, where professional academic curation comes in, because it's you're not imposing something from your present perspective, but you're looking at what the actual,
well, this is the understanding.
Evidence tells you of the time.
Yeah, because this is where the understanding comes in, isn't it? So it's, you look at something like that and you go, well, clearly that's not accurate, you know, because people weren't in those positions. They didn't hold those roles and that sort of stuff. What roles and what positions did they hold? And who was doing those roles? Why were they doing those roles? When did that change? Why were those roles perpetuated? These things are never used as a reason to find out more or an invitation to find out more, get involved in more things. You know, what's the impact of that thing there? Rather than trying to go the other way, which is everybody was involved and everybody was equal. No, they weren't. So what you're doing really with popular culture by making people like that represented in roles that they never actually did is you're giving people an out to find out what actually happened and why some of these things were still there.
And it also weakens the appreciation that we should have for people struggle to counterbalance some of those things. You know, I'm absolutely not arguing that if it's relevant, and if you're saying something is a piece of entertainment, fine. That's it. You're not trying to be accurate. But if you're trying to be accurate, you have to be accurate. You can't not. You know, it's a choice. It's a binary choice. It's either not accurate or it is accurate, and make it clear to your audience that it is. Don't go inventing things for the sake of it. Because what you actually do by that is you undervalue, or you I'm trying to find the right word. You disrespect the efforts and the what people fought for to change that, because then what you're presenting it as is somehow has been washed over. It's been washed with through the present lens, and it doesn't take into account the lens of when people were actually faced with those challenges.
Well, you're doing a disservice to the person, a disservice to the person that was actually there and actually fought for that right or that opportunity or
that equality.
People that genuinely fought for it. And you know, and if we all, no matter who you are, skin color, wherever you are, we all stand on the shoulder of giants. You know, people doing small acts of defiance, standing up, making something, allowing someone access, reaching down and helping someone, reaching across a divide and making these kind of consensus. And it's never as easy as the history books is, as a history book is dumbed down to, or a very simple timeline on the wall of a museum. It's where's the individual stories and the narratives of how long it took, who was involved, the struggles. And when you think some of the injustices that we have and we see regularly now, you know, women still struggling to be treated with equality on certain things, the gender pay gap, all of these things, they all come from narratives that have not been challenged because people just accept them.
So last section, I want to just focus on two things. There's the kind of practicalities, but crucially, what do you think the long-term value of this is? I mean, in that terms of providing an anchor point, a place for people to come and network with other people and connect with other people, that terrible word, network, and we need something else, and to share stories. Why is that important for looking forward? Why does this need to be something that's replicated everywhere in order to be able to, you know, as a kind of generalized thing, that these heritage fairs should be popping up all over the place?
Well, I think going back to the days of Citizens Eye, I remember when someone came to me, a guy called Simon, and he said, I'd like to set up a Citizens Eye in Derby. Can I license it or franchise it? I just laughed. And I said to him, well, what colour do you want the logo? And he said, well, I said, well, I'll make you one and send it to you. Good luck to you. Go for it. You know, Citizens Eye works because people will know because it was Leicester and Leicestershire. It was off its place. And I'm a great believer in that with Saturday Heritage Fair. You know, there's heritage related events happening all the time. People might not think they're heritage events. They think they're coffee mornings, or they think there's something else. They don't have to be called heritage fairs. They don't have to mention heritage. They have to be on a Saturday. It doesn't even have to be a fair. All I'm saying to people is get together with a group of like-minded people that would just like to own and shape their own narrative. Now, obviously, you could go off and do that from a very racist perspective of one-dimensional view of the world, and we'll leave that to political parties maybe to do. But I think there's also groups of people where getting together and realising that there's more that unites us than divides us, an old cliche, the more that we do that, can we really push back against some of the narratives that we get pushed in the media, in cahoots, if it sometimes it seems, with certain, you know, political parties and stuff, about who's at fault and whose fault was it and all that sort of stuff. Well, we've all got a part to play. Now, if you sit on the sides as a spectator, you know, can you really have an opinion unless you put yourself in there and score the goal, you know, and participate? It's so easy for us to use popular culture to just sit on the sidelines and blame someone else. And why didn't you do that? You missed the penalty. Let's ruin your life. We're happy to make you the youngest player in the team and then ruin your life when you miss the penalty. And I think we need to really think about how we've allowed that kind of viewpoint to filter through into everyday life, where we have opinions about people. If you've never met someone from that community, how can you think they're all like that? And of course, as soon as we stop pushing back against that. And so the Saturday Heritage Fair, I think, is just this very small thing. You know, it'll be once a year and it will just be an invitation for people to come involved. And if they want to do their own one, who can we help Can we help you do that? Can we share any resources with you? Because at the moment we have a project that the museum service runs where it takes, like, you know, cabinets of curiosity round to shopping centres and stuff to families. I've got a whole viewpoint on that. But it's, oh, come and have a look at the precious things. And, you know, it never seems to be about, have you got any precious things? Why don't you bring your precious things to come and see? And we'll see whether, you know, they could fit into the museum. It doesn't work like that, does it? Because the museum is showing you 10% at best of what it's got, and the other 90% you'll never get a chance to go and view. You know, there's a Heritage Open Day starting on Friday for a couple of weeks, I think it is, and you can book on. And there's a tour of the museum service storage place. Can't remember where it is now. 12 people can book on this tour. Okay, so is it all going to be staff members, friends of staff members? So we've got 370,000 people in the city, but 12 people will get to go and have a look behind the scenes of the stores. Where's the 15 tours for 12 people to go and look behind the stores? Because we've all seen what's in the museum, because it very rarely changes apart from certain things. We just need to wrestle back the narrative from the people that decide what's important and what we see and what gets put behind glass cabinets, because we don't need them behind glass cabinets. They need to be out, they need to be seen, because it could help us deal with a lot of the issues that we have today.
So some practical questions. Where's the event taking place? What can people expect on the day? And where do the people find out more information?
So it's on Saturday, 11th of October, between 10 and 3. If you turn up from 8:30 onwards, the old library cafe is open. Does a good cup of coffee and tea and some food, which is always good. Sausage rolls, totally agree with them. It's at the Leicester Adult Education Centre on Beaver Street, 54 Beaver Street, on the opposite the old Phoenix, which is now a hotel, I think. And also, some people will know, if you're a certain age, it used to be the old Central Lending Library before it popped around the corner onto Bishop Street. Just come along. The hall opens at 10. There'll be workshops. There's a film to watch. Come around. Just immerse yourself in it. Enjoy yourself. Bring an item if you want to. Please do. Have a conversation. Look for me. Tired, old, grey-haired man wandering around looking shattered. There's a really, really good surprise with someone that we've got as the MC as well, who's going to be playing sort of a combination of three or four historical characters, welcoming people from a sort of family-friendly perspective as well, which I think is great. And it's just about come along and, you know, if you don't want to talk to anyone, just wander around, just observe it and come back next year. If you've got an item that you want to find, you know, some backstory to, you've hit a brick wall with something that you're looking for, you know, you've spent a lot of money subscribing to a lot of things and you seem to be, have gone down a rabbit hole. What if on Saturday, the 11th of October by 3 o'clock, you can come in, get an answer to that, walk away and go, do you know what? That's answered something that I really needed to know about my community or my family. That's opened a whole new door for me. I'm now off into Wonderland. Or actually, it was just really cool to see lots of different people there from different communities in Leicester actually talking about things that are important to them. And maybe it just opened your eyes a little bit.
And we're going to be there as Soar Sound. We're going to be recording live on the day and broadcasting live from the event and capturing people's stories. So come and take part in that. We're also going to play out on some radios the oral history archive from the 1980s, which we hope we're going to have set up for people to listen to. So we're really looking forward to it. Thanks very much.
Thank you.